will knock off. We're going to be in Matthew chapter 26. We're down into the Lord's last, few hours, let's say, before the crucifixion. This is I'll show you here on this little chart thingy here in just a second. On this is just sort of a pinwheel of events. It's not intended to designate accurate times, but if you just kind of think of this being sort of around the midnight time frame where he was taken captive, now he's being led off to a series of, usually they're referred to as trials. That's being generous. They're more like hearings, and there will be a total of six of them. Three of them before the religious authorities of the nation, involving the Jews, and three of them before the civil authorities of Rome, the Gentiles, and between when he's taken captive and about 9 o'clock in the morning, where he's actually led away to the cross, is when these six different hearings take place. Now somebody, I forget who did this, came up with a list of 31 illegalities that characterize these hearings. That is 31 different offenses, illegal offenses, are recorded in these proceedings. And so that's why I don't like to use the word trial. That sort of implies something halfway honest and halfway judicious. This is just a bunch of kangaroo courts, if there ever were any. But that's what begins here in verse 57. So those who had seized Jesus led him away to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were gathered together. Now the first guy he actually went before was Annas. Annas was the previous high priest, kind of the high priest emeritus, last administration of high priests. They took him there first, because he kind of pulled the strings behind the priesthood anyway. He was sort of the muscle. And then they take him to Caiaphas. So when we pick up the narrative here in Matthew, he's actually at the second of those six hearings before Caiaphas, who was the high priest at this time. And it's at night. That's one of the major illegalities. They couldn't meet. They couldn't do things at night. But Peter was also following him at a distance as far as the courtyard of the high priest, and entered in and sat down with the officers to see the outcome. Now, he's already been told what the outcome is going to be, hasn't he? The Lord told him that he had to go up to Jerusalem, he would be handed over to the authorities, and he would suffer and die. So unless this ain't that event he was talking about, Peter really ought to know what the outcome's going to be, because he was told that in 17, 22, and 23, and in chapter 26 and verse 2, are two instances where Peter has been told what's going to happen here. So now the chief priests and the whole council kept trying to obtain false testimony against Jesus in order that they may put him to death. I mean, they're not interested in actually learning anything. They're trying to stack the deck here against him, looking for false testimony, somebody that will step up, even if he's a bold-faced liar, and say something that they can use against Jesus. So the whole thing is just an absolute unjust sham, if there ever was one. And they didn't find anybody. Even though many false witnesses came forward, that is, they couldn't find anybody to say anything that could actually stick, that they could use. Finally, a couple guys did come forward. And one of these two guys said, well, this man stated, I am able to destroy the temple of God and to rebuild it in 3 days. Did he say that? Is that what Jesus said? I can destroy this temple, your building there, your symbol of Jewish nationalism, I can destroy that thing and rebuild it in 3 days. Did he say that? No, he didn't say that. He said, if you destroy this temple, talking about his body, that's what he would restore in 3 days, talking about his own resurrection. He never threatened to destroy their temple, the house of God, the house that he called his own house. So it's just, again, another lie that they used to try to come up with something here. So they misstated that altogether. And so the high priest stood up and said to him, well, do you make no answer? What is it that these men are testifying against you? Isaiah 53:7 said that he didn't respond. He was like a sheep led to shearers. He made no response, and he's fulfilling that here. What's the point in arguing against lies that are intended to convict you anyway? There's no intention here. Kent, any hope of any electricity this morning?
We got a guy here working on it.
Okay.
So I think right now y'all are affected with air.
Okay.
Other rooms don't have any lights, so.
Oh, they don't have lights, huh?
Or air.
Oh, goodness. At least we can see to read the scriptures here in this room, so we're doing better than they are.
So there is a guy who's here. He thinks he's diagnosed the problem. He's trying to get a fuse.
Okay. I think I diagnosed the problem. There's no air. That's the problem. All right, good. Maybe something will happen before we go. Maybe it won't. At any rate, the Lord's not wasting his breath trying to defend himself against a stacked bunch of lies, and so he doesn't say anything. Jesus just kept silent. And the high priest said to him, I adjure you by the living God to tell us whether you are the Christ, the Son of God. What's he been doing for the last 3.5 years? He's been telling them that he is the Christ. I am the Christ. Behold, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. This is my house that you're destroying here. He claimed to be Messiah repeatedly and proved that through an endless variety of miracles. And now they're asking him, well, tell us whether or not you're actually the Christ. The absurdities of this thing just kind of keep going on and on here. And Jesus said to them, you have said it yourself. You said it. Your own words will condemn you. You know that I am him. Nevertheless, I tell you, hereafter you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven. How ironic that they, sitting in judgment on him, will ultimately be judged by him when he comes back the second time. Mankind will be at the judgmental mercy of him. And he tells him, nothing's going to happen here until I come back the second time. And so when he said that, the high priest tore his robes, saying he has blasphemed. The tearing of the robe is a symbol of a great angst at something. And so what he's doing is he's symbolizing by tearing his robes that Jesus' claim to be God is blasphemous. And so that's his conclusion. And by the way, you remember this is the guy that counseled them earlier that it's better for one man to die than for a riot or something to come up and the Romans come down and stomp on them. So his counsel has been for some time, now we need to kill this guy and get him out of here because he's a threat to our positions here before Rome. And so, oh wow, isn't it surprising that he concludes that the Lord blasphemed? So what do you think, he says? And they answered, well, he is deserving of death. So he's got all the support that he needs for that viewpoint. Then they spat in his face and beat him with their fists, and others slapped him. Now these are the Jews. We haven't gotten to the Romans' abuse yet. These are his countrymen. And if you just for a moment set aside the fact that this is God, the inhumanity to another human being is beyond understanding as well. Why would they treat anybody like this? There is a hatred for him that is being displayed here that is against rather incomprehensible. They spit on him, beat on him. I mean, he's helpless, he's tied up, he can't defend himself. He's blindfolded, we know from Luke, and so they're slapping him and then saying, well, who was that hit you? If you're a prophet, tell us who hit you. You got on a blindfold, so somebody smacks him and then says, who did that? It's just, it's hard to find the right words to describe the disgracefulness of this treatment of just one human being for another human being if there wasn't even any other issue here. And of his own countrymen doing that to him. So the type of death that he's going to die here is, it's hard to replicate in our minds as to what's going on here. It's just beyond comprehension. But now here's Peter. He was sitting outside in the courtyard, and a certain servant girl came to him and said, you too were with Jesus Jesus the Galilean. Now, among all of the different intimidating forces in the society at that time, a servant girl is the bottom rung on the ladder. Nobody pays any attention to a servant girl. wasn't paying attention to any female, and a servant female at that. So this is the least intimidating person you could encounter in the Jewish society. And she says to Peter, hey, you were with him there. And he denied it before them all, saying, I don't know what you're talking about. Remember what the Lord had told him?
Yeah.
How many times was this going to happen? All right, this is number one. First denial is just sort of a general broad brush denial. But when he'd gone out to the gateway, another servant girl saw him and said to those who were there, this man was with Jesus of Nazareth. And again he denied it, this time with an oath. When you attach an oath to something, you're basically inviting God's punishment of you if that isn't true. You're saying, if I ain't telling you the truth, may lightning strike me where I stand. Zap! The guy gets struck by lightning because he's lying. So he's adding another layer here. He's actually inviting God to punish him if he's not saying the truth. That makes it even more serious. I do not know the man. 3.5 years, joined at the hip with him almost day in and day out. And he says, I don't know the guy. You just have to hope that Jesus can't hear this. But he can. And a little later, bystanders came up and said to Peter, surely you are one of them, for the way you talk gives you away. The Galilean spoke with a certain accent. They were all from Mississippi. Who pronounced Mississippi, Mississippi. They drop a syllable. I guess it's too long a word to say so many times. His speech gave him away, and they know it. And so they say, hey, I know how you're talking, that you were one of them. Then he began to curse and swear, I do not know the man. This time he adds even more divine judgment upon himself by adding curses to his own life and to his own speech here, and again denies knowing our Lord. So there's the three denials. And immediately a cock crowed. That might involve a rooster, that might involve a reference to a Roman system of counting time overnight. Remember, they had these four intervals from like 6 in the evening to 6 the next morning. And each of those intervals had a certain name. I think it was 3-4 hour intervals. And the last one of those was called the cock crow. So that may be what's actually referred to, and it comes translated to us as something we think involves a rooster. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. I don't know. Doesn't matter. But it might help to explain why there's a rooster all of a sudden in the scene. And Peter remembered the words which Jesus said, before the cock crows, you will deny me 3 times. And he went out and wept bitterly. This is an eternal example of the failure of the flesh to accomplish anything that is of eternal value. Peter was so certain of himself that he wouldn't deny the Lord, that he made that incredible boast that, hey, these other guys might. These guys, you know, they're nothing. They got no spines, but not me. I won't deny you. And unfortunately, he had to eat some serious crow here, and proves how little can be accomplished in the flesh. So his denial was indeed fulfilled as prophesied. And by the time, get that thing off, that thing's just generating heat too, isn't it? So by the time he got around to the third denial, then the time frame that the Lord said was up. So now when morning had come, got to turn it back on for a second. So we've come back on around to somewhere in this general area here, maybe 6 o'clock in the morning type time frame, daylight breaking or whatnot. When Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that he had been condemned, he felt remorse and returned the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders. And you got to wonder, what in the world did Judas expect to happen? Was he thinking that maybe the Lord would just get humiliated in some way and discredited, and that would kind of be the end of it? No, he should have known. They wanted blood. They wanted him dead. They're not out for some kind of a discrediting operation here. They're wanting to kill him. So what did he think would happen when he agreed to be the mouthpiece for the prosecution. But he takes his money back and saying he felt some form of remorse and says, well, I've sinned betraying innocent blood. And they said, well, what do we care? We got a ball rolling downhill here and we're just going to let it roll. Beg your pardon?
Where are you reading?
I'm in 27, 3, and 4.
Okay.
27, 3, and 4. Okay, everybody, did I jump ahead or something?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, yeah. 27, 3, and 4. And verse 5, he threw the pieces of silver into the sanctuary and departed, and he went away and hanged himself. So he just returns the money, they didn't care, so he throws it into the sanctuary and goes out and hangs himself. Now, other places in Scripture tell us that his body fell down and was actually literally burst open. So a couple of different explanations could come to mind. One, he either hanged himself over the edge of a cliff on a tree branch or something, and maybe it broke and he fell and got mangled. Or it may be that he hanged himself and some people saw him, and in order to remove him, you don't want a guy hanging on a tree overnight for Passover and all that stuff, that they took him over to the valley of the where they burned their trash and all that stuff, that 400-foot valley right there off the edge of Jerusalem, and just threw him down in there. That's what they did with a lot of the indigent. They just threw him down in the valley and let him burn or whatnot. So he might have gotten chucked off of a cliff by virtue of his being hanging on a tree and got thrown down in there. I don't know. Either way, his end was pretty disgusting when it not only hanged himself, but he got busted up. And then the chief priests then take the 30 pieces of silver and check this out. They said, well, it's not lawful to put them into the temple treasury since it is the price of blood. Isn't this wonderful? They become scrupulous over some rinky-dink, nothing law of how to manage the money while killing Jesus in the process. It's incredible. Not lawful to put this money somewhere else. We got to manage this correctly, guys. But that's okay. Kill this innocent guy over here. It doesn't matter to us. They counseled together, and with the money, they bought the potter's field as a burial place for strangers. So they spent that money and bought this field. Apparently, it was heavily clayed so that potters used to go in there and gather up clay for doing their potter thing. And so they bought that, and they used that field to bury, again, indigent, non-Jewish types, usually, who couldn't be buried in other places, and so it was sort of a last-ditch place to bury people. That which was spoken through Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled. Now, the reference that he quotes here is actually in Zechariah 11, 12, and 13, but it's referred to through Jeremiah the prophet because used to be the prophetic books were organized where Jeremiah was the first one, and so all of the prophetic books were talked about as a reference to Jeremiah. So even the other ones that came behind him, all were under that, and so that's why it is said that it was Jeremiah who spoke this, when in reality it was Zechariah 11, 12, and 13. They took 30 pieces of silver, the price of one whose price had been set by the sons of Israel, and they gave them for the potter's field as the Lord directed me. So in Zechariah, the lament there is that they valued Messiah to be worth 30 pieces of silver, which is the price you would pay for a slave. So the nation valued their Messiah like they would have valued a slave, 30 pieces of silver. That's the lament there in Zechariah. How you doing? You want to go on or you want to get out of here?
No.
You all right?
You're hot.
What's that?
You're hot.
Okay.
Go.
All right. We'll go a little further then. So that is the brief description of Judas's end, which was indeed terrible. His life is just an example of the greatest failure that you can come up with anywhere. So now Jesus stood before the governor. So now we're going to see the three civil hearings, trials, if you want to call them that. One will be before Pilate, and then he goes over to Herod, and I'll tell you why, and then he comes back before Pilate. First appearance before Pilate, and the governor questioned him, saying, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Why would Pilate be interested in that question? King of the Jews. That would make him a threat to Rome, wouldn't it? If he's a king of some other kingdom, within the Roman sphere, within the Roman domain, he could be a threat to Rome. And that's what they're looking for. The Jews want to find something that makes Jesus a threat to Rome. Why? Because Rome can kill him. The Jews can't. The Jews cannot execute anybody. If they could execute anybody, they'd execute the Romans. So the Romans didn't let them do that. So they've got to find a charge against him that makes him a threat to Rome so that Rome would kill him. They could, of course, execute. That's what they're after. So they must have said something to him about it and made Pilate aware that possibly Jesus is a threat to Rome. So he says, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And the Lord said, "It is as you say." He admitted that that was indeed his role. Now, in other places, we know in these conversations that he told Pilate that he was not a threat to Rome. He said his kingdom is not of this world. But they probably don't care, probably don't even understand. So he was being pressed a little further, and while he was being accused by the chief priests and the elders, he made no answer. And so Pilate, seeing that he doesn't say anything, says to him, "Well, don't you hear all this? Do you not hear how many things they testify against you?" And he did not answer him with regard to even a single charge, so that the governor was quite amazed. It would be amazing, wouldn't it? A guy being, in essence, prosecuted doesn't make any defense of himself here. And that surprised Pilate greatly. Now, it was at the feast, the governor was accustomed to release for the multitude any one prisoner whom they wanted. Now, what Matthew doesn't develop for us here, and John and other guys do, is that Pilate's between a rock and a hard place. He hates the Jews, and they hate him. But they're managing to finagle him and to coerce him into doing something he doesn't want to do. He doesn't necessarily want to condemn Jesus. He can't find any real basis for that. But he also doesn't want a subjugated, riotous people that he has to take care of, because his bosses will come in there and replace him if he can't keep peace and harmony in the kingdom there. And so he doesn't want a problem. And they're squeezing him into this bind of trying to make him kill Jesus when he doesn't really want to. So he's looking for a way to wiggle out. And so he's going to use this tradition of releasing for them each year some offender, some criminal, as a good gesture. So he's thinking, "Hey, I'll offer them up the choice between this miserable murdering dog we got over here, Barabbas, and Jesus," thinking they'll pick Jesus. Who would pick Barabbas to be released in their right minds, right? He's a threat to the nation. He's like releasing O.J. Simpson. They don't want to do that. So he thinks that will work and will get him out of here. So he proposes this then. They got Barabbas. When they were gathered together, Pilate said to them, verse 17, "Whom do you want me to release to you, Barabbas or Jesus who's called Christ?" So he's thinking, "Well, they'll say Jesus, and that'll get me out of this mess I'm in." Good plan, but it didn't work. They knew that because of envy they had delivered him up, and while he was sitting at the judgment seat, his wife sent to him, saying, "Have nothing to do with that righteous man, for last night I suffered greatly in a dream because of him." His wife counsels him to not mess with Jesus, to don't do him any harm, any hurt, because she had a dream about him, and it really bothered her, and so she passed that on to him. And that just added, I guess, to his stress, because he can't find a way out of not condemning Jesus. But the governor answered and said to them, "Which do you want?" And Pilate, verse 20, "But the chief priests and the elders persuaded the multitudes to ask for Barabbas and to put Jesus to death." So apparently the leadership moves amongst the crowd and tells everybody, pick Barabbas as the one to be released, not Jesus. And they do. Clearly these guys are extremely influential, aren't they? The Jewish leadership was very, very influential. They definitely bear the brunt for this decision. So they pick Barabbas. So Pilate's plan didn't work out like he'd hoped. So he says to them, "Well, what shall I do with Jesus who is called Christ?" And they all said, "Well, let him be crucified." So the crowd, with the aids of their leadership, whipping them up, calls out for Jesus to be crucified. And he kept saying, well, what evil has he done? And they kept shouting all the more, saying, let him be crucified. Clearly, there is no interest here in any sort of truth. It's just a mob action wanting him to be crucified. And by the way, he had gone to Herod and come back to Pilate in the meantime. So this is kind of the end of the threesome here that we're talking about. So when Pilate saw that he was accomplishing nothing, but rather that a riot was starting, he took water and washed his hands in front of the multitude, saying, I am innocent of this man's blood. See to that yourselves. I guess he's trying to somehow or another disassociate himself from any responsibility or any guilt in this matter by washing his hands, figuratively saying, hey, I got nothing to do with this. This is all on you. Well, who's the governor, them or him? What he should have been looking for in that bowl he was washing his hands in is a spine that he could use, because he didn't have one. And so he gives in. And all the people answered and said, his blood be on us and our children. Man, what a statement that is, verse 25. His blood be on us and our children. What's happened down through the years? Is there a race of people on this planet any more persecuted than the Jews? Can't think of one. Been pretty rough. But they invited upon himself in verse 25. So he released Barabbas for them, but after having Jesus scourged, he delivered him to be crucified. Now, this scourging is done with a little device that was called a cat of nine tails, a stick, and had these leather straps coming off the end of it, maybe 10 or so. And there would be a piece of bone or metal embedded in the end of the strap, so that you're whacking somebody with what would normally be a leather whip, but it had these bone chips or metal chips embedded in the end of it, so it sliced you up in the process. So it didn't just hurt, it cut you up.
Tore him up.
Yeah, just ate the flesh off of your back if you get hit with this thing. So it was a devastating device that he's being scourged with and being beaten with. And it helps to explain why he couldn't carry his own cross member, because he probably lost enough blood that he was just fatigue, you know, just too weak to do it. So it was a device that not only hurt, but it cut you up in the process. And so they did that to him. Then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the praetorium and gathered the whole Roman cohort around him. Now, a Roman cohort's about 500 or 600 guys, and they would be stationed here. So they've come from the area down in through here up to this little region up here, which isn't very far. Let's see, got a legend on this sucker. Oh yeah, maybe an eighth of a mile, something like that. So that's not too far. They've moved from down in this region up to here. And all 500 or 600 of these Roman soldiers are there now to have fun abusing him. So the abuse has come from the Jews before to now the Gentiles, a part of these Roman soldiers. And they stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him. And after weaving a crown of thorns, they put it on his head. The Romans would keep sort of barrels of these thorns. They're about this long, these long 5 or 6 inch jobbies. They're not the little bitty rose thorns that we think of. But these big ones, they'd keep them in these barrels around the barracks for kindling to start fires with in the winter. So they're handy. So there's a bunch of these thorns, these big sucker thorns around, and they apparently then take some of these and weave them into some sort of a laurel-like wreath and becomes a crown of thorns, and he put it on his head. Now, how do you think you put that on somebody's head? You go, you know, you stick it in his head. Those thorns would clearly puncture his skin, to say the least, and maybe even part of his skull. And then on top of that, they smack him on top of the head with a stick. Verse 30. They're kneeling before him and mocking him and all this kind of stuff. and beating him in the head with this wreath of needles, impaling him in the head, no doubt. So again, it's just kind of hard to get our minds around the inhumanity that these guys are capable of. The depravity of man, it just knows no limits. What has he done to these Roman soldiers? What race do they have? What horse do they have in this race? They don't care if he's the king of the Jews or who he is or what claim he made. He's just somebody that they can abuse. They're just delighting in their abuse of him. And I imagine that every blow that was landed on his head or on his face just brought glee to the face of Satan, that he was just giddy with delight at seeing the Lord suffer. What more could he possibly want than to inflict pain and suffering on the Son of God, his arch enemy? And so he's probably somewhere in the midst of this stuff, grinning from ear to ear with giddy delight at watching these depraved, miserable excuses for human beings inflict this kind of hatred and punishment on a man who had done nothing to anybody to deserve any kind of cruel punishment like this. Who's this guy hurt? Who's he offended? Whose property did he steal? Never done a thing to anybody. He just helped the race as much as he could, cured as many things as he came across, and helped people in every instance of encountering him. And this is the depravity of godless man on display here. The Jews before and the Gentiles here, both are culpable in this display. So after they'd mocked him, they took his robe off and put his garments on him and led him away to crucify him. Why did they put his garments back on him? Remember that passage in Isaiah about they divided up my garments? He has to have those garments back on, doesn't he? They don't know what they're doing, but they're fulfilling prophecy by putting his garments back on him so that at the cross they can cast lots for his garments in accordance with those scriptures. So they don't know it, but God is tweaking them to do what the scripture said had to be done. So they put his garments back on him and he led him away to crucify him. And it looks like the guy that made this map up, this looks like about a quarter of a mile from here over to here. I don't know what route they took. Maybe they went around like that so that maybe it's closer to a half a mile or three quarter. Those of you that have been over there, you have any idea? Anybody been there and been to Jerusalem and seen this? What do you think?
Well, I don't remember it being like that, but my memory is not too clear on it anyway.
Okay. Wasn't terrible. It wasn't like 5 miles away, though, was it?
No.
Fairly close. Quarter mile, half a mile, something like that?
Yeah.
Okay. So he's got to get from where they were abusing him here, somehow or another outside the city, I don't know if he come through it or go around, to somewhere over in this area. At least this guy thinks that, the guy made this map up. Well,
the place of the skull now, you know, that Calvary is the place of the skull. You could actually see that looked like a skull there.
Oh, is that right? It has the appearance of a skull?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, what the Romans did in order to crucify somebody, it looks like the vertical members of the cross sort of semi-permanently stuck in the ground, but they made their victims carry the cross member. There's three of them on this particular day, the Lord and two other guys, we'll see in a minute. So he's got to carry this cross member, which is probably about like a railroad tie. You ever done any landscape work? Try to move around some railroad ties and stuff like that? A young, healthy man can barely handle one. Now, the Lord ain't that old, but he ain't healthy. He's been beat to a pulp, probably lost who knows how much blood. He's weakened. He's been up all night. I mean, he's barely able to even get on his feet, and they try to make him carry his cross member over to the execution site, and he can't do it. There was a man coming from Cyrene. This would be up in what is today Libya, I believe. A guy named Simon. He's got some biblical history, by the way. It's interesting to kind of track him down a little bit. He happened to be around, and so they pressed him into service and made him carry Jesus' cross since he couldn't carry it himself. Kind of a symbol, a clear-cut human symbol of what we do as we bear his cross in our lives as well. Physically, he's carrying it here, but what we do generally, of course, is suffer the same humiliation and difficulties and sufferings by association with him as a result of our faith in him. We also share his glory, and so we have to share his suffering, as Paul said, and so this guy sort of symbolizes that in carrying this cross member. And so when they came to the place called Golgotha, which means place of a skull, they gave him wine to drink mingled with gall. That's sort of a narcotic. All right, so we're about on this events wheel here now. We're about around here around 9 o'clock in the morning now. So he's been up all night and so on. So they gave him this wine mingled with gall. And after tasting it, he was unwilling to drink. This would be like giving him a morphine shot. And he said, no, I'm not going to do that. I want to be totally in charge of my faculties. I'm not going to take this narcotic. He's doing something here very consciously, very purposefully, and he doesn't want it to be in any way distorted by a narcotic, so he refuses that one. And when they had crucified him, they divided up his garments among themselves, casting lots. That's a fulfillment of Psalm 22:18. Remember, we said he had to have his garments put back on in order for this to happen. So they do. They put his garments on him, and then they cast lots for them. It's interesting that one of his garments was a... it's kind of... Y'all all right? Want to go on or head for the house?
Two people have zipped up their Bibles, if that means anything.
They've done what?
Zipped up their Bibles.
Zipped up their Bibles?
I heard them zip them up.
I tell you what.
Well, it's not that uncomfortable, Don.
You doing all right?
Yeah. Unless you are.
I'm all right.
Okay.
All right, we'll try to go a little further then. All right. They divided up his garments. One of those pieces was a unit that was knitted or sewn or prepared by apparently his mother. Most Jewish mothers, when their children would reach adulthood, about 18 or so, would make them this long, it was sort of like an undergarment, kind of like a pair of long johns, only not separate into a top and bottom, but one long piece. And their mothers would make them those, and that kind of was a parting deal. They'd, you know, go on off them, but they had that garment. One piece, made out of one piece. That apparently is the one piece that they decided not to divide because it would ruin it if you tore that thing up. It was intended to be left in one piece. And it's probable that Mary was standing there watching them when they divided those things up and somebody got that one piece garment that she had made for him. And so that's probably when he looked at John and said, "Behold your mother." In other words, you take charge of her and you take responsibility for her from now on, was when they took the tore up that, or not tore up, but cast lots for that one garment that his mother had made. So that's why those things had to be put back on him for that to be fulfilled. So they sat down and they did that and just sat there and watched him, verse 36. And they put above his head a charge against him, which read, a charge against him. That's ironic. It's the truth. This is Jesus, King of the Jews. That's the charge against him. A statement of fact. Now, you remember the Jews didn't like that. So they went to Pilate and said, don't put that sign up there. Put a sign that says, he said I am the King of the Jews. Not that he is the King of the Jews. And Pilate said, get lost. I'm not changing it. And that galled them.